Was ist gut? Ein Podcast des Deutschen Designer Club.
Klimawandel ist Fakt und Transformation deshalb ein Muss. Also, das folgt unweigerlich, müssen wir alles, was und wie wir produzieren, auf den Prüfstand stellen. Und das fängt eigentlich schon bei den Materialien an, die wir nutzen. Kunststoffe, zum Beispiel für deren Herstellung fossile Rohstoffe wie Öl, genutzt werden, dürfte es bald nicht mehr geben. Materialien müssen komplett neu gedacht werden. Wenn wir die angeschlagene Gesundheit des Planeten noch retten wollen, ist aber auch Verzicht notwendig. Brauchen wir ständiges Wachstum und unendlichen Überfluss wirklich? Genau an dieser Stelle stehen DesignerInnen heute vor gewaltigen Herausforderungen. Aber sie sind es auch, die gute Lösungen schaffen können. Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge unseres Podcasts Was ist gut? Über die Rolle von Design und Architektur in der Transformation. Mein Name ist Rainer Gerisch. Unser heutiger Studiogast ist Hella Jongerius. Die Niederländerin lebt und arbeitet seit vielen Jahren in Berlin. Sie gilt völlig zu Recht als eine der bedeutendsten Farb- und Texturdesignerinnen der Welt. Bei ihrer jahrelangen Arbeit als Artdirektorin für Vitra oder mit wirklich riesigen Recycling-Designprojekten für die niederländische Airline KLM hat sie Schlagzeilen gemacht und zahlreiche Preise gewonnen. Ihre teuer gehandelten Arbeiten befinden sich in den wichtigsten Museumssammlungen dieser Welt. Sie forscht mit ihrem Team zum Beispiel über das Weben, über die Wiederbelebung vergessener Techniken und über digitale Webstühle und dreidimensionale Textilien. Sie ist der festen Überzeugung, dass unsere gesamte industrielle Welt verändert werden muss. Zum Beispiel sollte an die Stelle des Verkaufs von Industrieprodukten das Vermieten treten, damit die Industrie für den gesamten Produktlebenszyklus die volle Verantwortung übernimmt. Mit Hella spricht mein Kollege Georg Christoph Bertsch nun über ihre unendliche Faszination für Farbe und darüber, wieso Texturen Objekte menschlicher machen. Wir also mehr brauchen als gläserne Touchscreens. Einfach deshalb, weil wir eben Menschen sind.
Hi, good to see you, Hella. I think we talked in January. Where are you right now?
I'm now in Berlin. Hello.
Good to have you here in the remote studio. For me, it's a great pleasure after the first conversation that we had now to join again. Got a lot of questions. And when I talked to people that we would have this conversation, they said, well, she's such a relevant designer, maybe the most relevant designer in the world. And so, well, I wanted to ask you whether you think you are relevant and what concept of relevance do you have?
Well, yeah, what is relevant? For myself, I find it, since I started, very important that I touch the time. So that I react on the time that we are living in and trying to understand it. And so relevance is for me that you come with a solution or a thought or getting lost on topics that need energy to move on in general, to move on for better solutions in our lives, for people, for human beings.
I think there's one notion in it, which I like very much. You said in our time. So I think it's quite easy to say we are living in our time. But from your perspective as a designer, what is our time?
Now? You mean now? Our time now?
Yeah, I mean now. So what is, if you look at, you as a designer, look at our time and I say, what is our time?
Our time is now, I think we are in transformation. So we have all these huge problems in the world. So our time is now, for me, what is now totally relevant is rethinking of materials. So design materials in another way. And that's for me now most relevant, was always relevant. So the way we produce our products or objects in the industrial world was always my topic. So like imperfection, that was the start, and thinking of using craft or till the the important parts of craft, to take that with us to an industrial production. So material and production was always a topic in my oeuvre, but now it is a topic which is much more relevant because we have this planet that is going to die. So we have to find new solutions. So planet needs to be first. And since we have this oil crisis now, we really have to rethink all materials based on fossil oil sources. So materials is now a topic for everybody. So not only for designers, also for politics, people who are in charge. In that sense, what I find interesting is now that the design profession falls together with the time, the relevance of the larger topics in time. And that's an interesting moment, I would say, for the profession, because we have to rethink all our materials. That's a design topic. And we have to see what is the social life of our objects, of our products? How can we stop the growth, stop consuming? So it's another approach than design whatever, but it is our profession and it has always been my interest to think in on another level about my profession and question my profession against the time.
So this is, I think what I love about this is this meta perspective on the profession. Thinking about not just being a designer, but thinking about what being a designer means, or also thinking about the responsibility of this group of professions that can be combined as what we call design. So if you just mentioned the planetary perspective. So if, let's say for a moment, you would be the design minister of the world, what would you order the industry to do from this planetary perspective? As you were, let's say, the minister or the king of the world, queen of the world. So you are the queen of the world. So what would you order the industry to do?
I would love to be the queen of the world, there is huge pressure on my shoulders right now. But yeah, I don't think the industry is the place where we need to start the system change. The system change is the capitalistic system change. But on the other hand, what I would really love to see as a change is that we as consumers are no longer the owners of a product. So the industries need to stay the owner of a product, of an object, of a material. And as soon as we are using it as consumers and that doesn't function anymore or it doesn't fit with your situation where how you live, you can give it back to the industry, to the companies, and they can take care of the waste. So they can recycle it, they can repair it, and to give this responsibility back to the ones who are making the products is a way that materials are no longer getting lost, because materials are most important sources right now that we have to protect. You know, we have really a problem if we buy something, because what we cannot do anything with the waste, but you know, you give it away to somebody else, but then this person has a problem, or you throw it away. So repairing is often not possible. And if you give it back to a company, they can take care of it. And they will also design the product differently, because it costs money if they get their products very quickly back or broken, or, you know, it's another way of producing. So I would change that immediately if I was the queen of the world.
Okay. So let's get back to practice. Let's say to one project, which I quite a famous project of yours is this KLM project, where you, let's say, transformed, as you, where you just did exactly what you just mentioned. You started a kind of recycling within different product genres. So maybe I would like to know a little bit more about that. How did this start, and why did they actually ask you to do so? Or maybe better for the listeners, what did you do and who came up with the idea?
Well, it's always the same when a company approach me with a question. I always have my questions back, you know, why? And have you look at it in this sense and whatever? So they ask me, they came, people from KLM, from the Dutch aviation company, they came to my studio and they asked me, can you do the upholstery of the chairs of the Boeing 747? They wanted to buy another 22 planes. And I said, well, you know, that's the upholstery, but what are you doing with the seat and with the whole cabin? You know, there is so much more than just an upholstery. And then they said, yeah, well, we just buy it. You know, we buy the chair. Yeah, what a waste of an opportunity. You know, I could also design the chair and I could design the carpet and whatever, you know. So, and we end up that it was the full cabin because they saw an opportunity. So in the first flights, I couldn't do the first Boeings. I couldn't do it because they already bought the chair. So I could only do small additions. But the second seat I redesigned and the third one too for the 787. And so, yeah, I started to think, how can you add more quality into the materials? That was the main idea, to come up with real leather, with wool, with different colors that you each have their own color, but also to use recycle the stewardess uniforms because they received a new uniform and they had a mountain of waste of these blue uniforms of the stewards and stewardesses. And so I thought I spin it again and make new wool out of it and I use it in the carpet. So the carpet is a cradle to cradle carpet. Everything was first for business class, but now we roll it out, the whole idea, also for economy. So something like this starts as a very small question. And as soon as you are in contact and you come with quality or with good ideas and you need some massage and you need to, you know, get on your way, you need to find the right person on the other side of the table. And then you really can, you know, if you take time and you really dive into the processes, visit the mills and try to find this recycling idea of spinning, because it was very difficult to find a spin factory who could recycle this yarns again. And in the end, you have a journey and we ended up with an interesting new approach within aviation. It's, of course, with many, many boundaries, but I think it was a good job within the restrictions that I received.
Well, I think this, what you just mentioned last, is this incredibly regulated industries, safety, security topics, emergency topics and so on. And so health topics, air quality. So this brings an enormous complexity into what you just said. It's not just like manufacturing yarn. It's, let's say, dealing with all these fire topics and so on. And so how do you, because this is very, very complex, how do you work your way into these kinds of depth of a reach of a product like this textile that you've been creating there?
Yeah, well, to design a new seat, that's very complex, as you said. So yeah, you know, you start just as a naive person and, you know, I'm a beginning, I'm an amateur, and I also come with questions nobody ever asked. And I'm sitting there around a table with engineers and they all have no clue and they come with topics that I think, oh Lord, how can you think this way? You know, so I'm an alien, they are an alien at the table, and we learn from each other. It's not something you do overnight. So you grow into a topic. I'm making my models by hand. So first I came with seat models, and then you go to the Boeing factory and you talk it all over. And then you know, like, oh no, this part is part of a mold that needs to contain whatever wiring, this or that. And so this whole system of looking at your, this whole topic of looking at the screen, this has a lot of wiring and all the safety issues that nobody has to, yeah, you know, it's immense. There are so many rules, but I think each rule and each boundary is another way of being creative again. You know, it's an opportunity to try to go beyond or have another solution. And sometimes I was really so out of the box. Nobody could ever, you know, they were laughing at me sometimes, but I didn't care because I thought, you know, you never know. Maybe there is a solution. So, and we had many, many meetings and suddenly on a certain moment, you come there and they built my idea or the idea of what I wanted to see as a seat. And then there are like 300 red stickers on each part of the seat. that I had to change because it didn't, you know, didn't connect to whatever what. So then you start to work on the red stickers, and it's just, in a way, it is not rocket science. Although you think it's rocket science, it is just walking your path and don't be afraid and work in a team that is open for a new journey. Yeah, that's what it is.
I love this description of the red stickers. So this is also kind of, this is kind of research driven and prototyping driven design. Mm-hmm. So you really, do you have a, let's say, a full scale concept in the beginning of the process, or do you just work your way through this?
Okay. I work my way through. So the last years I did a lot of research on color, on weaving, two big exhibitions on weaving. Mm-hmm. And then I just start and try to get lost, because that's a challenge to get lost. And I think if you're getting lost, because in a way I have got such a back of knowledge and experience, it's more difficult to get lost. And I think if you get lost, you find new ways or new connections. And, you know, I make 50 times more than I present. So I make so much, and I try so much models and things and stuff. We throw away a lot. And then on a certain moment, you know, like, okay, yeah, yeah, this makes sense. Yeah. And if we connect this model with that model or this way. So it's really a research in building models and weaving, and do it in carton and do it in paper and then do it in the computer and start to engineer. And so, yeah, it is. It's a nice, vibrant, dynamic way of researching. It's. I think that's what is called design research.
Absolutely. So, but specifically on color research, because you mentioned color research, you could look at color system like Itten's color system or Goethe's color system, or Joseph Albers as one of the masters of color combinations. So, how do you research on color? Because you just described the process, a research and prototyping process with objects, a three-dimensional process. So is color also three-dimensional for you?
Yeah, or? I think the question color came in very practically with Vitra. So I had to study it on objects. So the question from Vitra was, can you come up with a new color range for the classics? So it was immediately on 3D objects and very practical, also industrial practical, that you only can have like four chairs. For some chairs, you only have like 7 different colors, and for other chairs, you could do 20 different colors. Also for my textiles that I do for my harem, you always have 7 colors. Well, if you have 7 colors for an object, you have black and white, you have gray, you have red and green, then you already have 5 colors. Then you only have 2 colors left to fill this in. So it's quite restricted if you work for industry. So then I wanted to find out more about coloring, and not the system, the industrial systems that you were talking about. They provide a lot of colors. There's an immense amount of colors, but the quality of the colors, the recipes are very poor. So the ingredients of the recipe is shallow, you know, not so rich as that we know it from art. And they are so shallow because of economic reasons, because it's cheaper, but also to keep them stable during the day. And I think this is really a lack of quality. I think a color needs to breathe with the light, has to change over the day, during the day. And this is a research that I developed, and I started to not make my own colors, because there are not enough colors, but also work with smaller industries who are doing more richer color recipes, and start to build models, like models how I can catch the colors. So with a lot of folding, because with a fold in a product, you see that the light hits the product differently. What is it when the light comes from underneath or on top? How does a color behave in the shadow? These kind of topics, like in an abstract way, looking at colors that breathe with light, with shadow, with gloss, with edge, with an edge. So that was an abstract way of looking at color. And I knew I had a show to present it in London, the London Design Museum. So there was an end goal, what I always like. So you have a goal to reach. And this is the way I worked on this color phenomenon.
This Peter Sloterdijk just published a book with a title, Who Hasn't Thought Gray Can't Be a Philosopher, in reference to Cézanne, who said, who hasn't painted gray can't be a painter. So yeah. Gray, if I say gray, what do you say?
Gray? I say, yeah, why not? Gray. Yeah. Jesper
okay.
John. Gray. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's also Gerhard Richter.
Yeah.
A lot of gray, but I think it's a very interesting thought. Who hasn't thought gray can't be a philosopher. I think it's against black and white differentiation. This kind of, it's kind of a political statement to say we should be able to see and thinking in gray, shades of gray.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, if you talk about gray and you talk about black and white, there is not one white and there is not one black. You know, there is a world of blacks, there is a world of whites, and you can make different grays with this black and white starting point. So, well, that's what I wanted to add to this conversation about grays.
It's a little bit in the direction of Malevich. Your works are kind of treated like art, I would say, in a way, being collected in major collections, being shown in exhibitions around the world. And how do you describe the difference between a fine artist and what you do? I mean, you are working with the same material, but you're evidently a designer. I would say you're definitely an industrial designer. How do you describe it? We had this discussion in several DD casts before with philosophers and practitioners, but what is your differentiation between fine art and design?
Well, for me, for myself, I would say my working method is the working method of an artist. So getting lost, having my own questions, having my own moral compass. But in the end, I am interested in daily products. That's my topic. That's a topic that I find interesting because of its social relevance. And also, if you change something from within this topic, because I find it important that it has a relevance, that change something, it pushes an envelope, then you push a bigger or you create a larger change if it is produced industrially. So you change something within the system. And if you only do one thing like an artist, then I find it, for myself, is not compelling. Yeah, I have another goal that I find interesting.
Well, it's a very clear answer here. For me, it's important to just like to compare it also to other perspectives. And the relevance of a decision in industrial design takes us much further. So if you say better or good decisions in big series, make an impact on the world. That's obvious, yeah. Much bigger impact than a painting.
Yeah.
You work with the distinction between absence and presence. I mean, I think it's very interesting to think, well, what is absence and presence? So I can imagine what presence means in terms of being somewhere, but how do you deal with absence?
Absence. I think I'm very happy that some of the products or objects in your life are absent, although they are there. You know, if you look at the relation you have with your products around you and this social life of our products, the association we have with our products, the stickiness of some products. So I would say the stickiness, you can't have all products around you that sticks because it's too loud. So it's too much, you know, you can't live. So some of the products, they just have to function. And if they don't function, they are present. And if they don't function, if they function, they are absent and they just do their job. So not every product needs to have an authorship or a presence. It's very peaceful if some products just perform. And are not loud, so don't have a color, don't have a presence, just function and do their job. So this is a way, how I analyze objects and work.
you've been working in a, I would say, super responsible position at Vitra. So I would like to better understand how big this responsibility is, what you're actually doing there, because you are obviously influencing the entire program. And this is the first question. And the second, what can your SOFA, your WeTrust SOFA, tell us for the future? So this is, I think I would combine these two questions.
Okay. Yeah, for the job I was doing for WeTra, because, you know, I built up this color and material library. So a concept to create an interesting color world and for the classics, but also for the relevant, for the contemporary designers. So it is a system that I left behind, and I built up a textile group of materials for them. I left it behind because I think, you know, I'm not... There are also others who can take care of this model that I built. And I'm also, the last years, I'm no longer interested to work for industries. So I left the industries behind because I don't believe I can add something to the systems. Just making new products, I'm not interested in. So only if it really is an interesting question, but I don't get interesting questions, to be honest. So I left it behind. I'm still in the sustainability board of WeTra. So we are rethinking of how to deal with this new approach on materials and beyond greenwashing and really do it very serious. So we are already for 2 years in a very serious program to rethink on all objects within the program of WeTra. I'm still involved in this part, and that's also what I find very interesting, because it's only about materials, trying to find other ways of producing and materials. What was the second question? I forgot.
The second is what your SOFA, your WeTra SOFA, can tell us for the future, because I think it's a very interesting, it's also a program. You just mentioned programs. You're very programmatic in a way. You build up systems that others can work with. You just mentioned you left something behind that others can use as a quarry, just like as a whatever. So just like, what is the programmatic aspect about this SOFA, which I like very much?
Which SOFA? The last one or the first one? Polder or the...
The first one.
Yeah. Yeah, this is this product that has different colors, different material in one SOFA. Because a SOFA is an example of... It has to be absent because it's so large. It's the most large piece in the house as a piece of furniture. So it needs to be absent, but it can be present a bit more than just a block of foam. So it is quite difficult to reach an interesting approach for a SOFA. And this one I did with this whole idea of asymmetrical and different materials, different colors, different materials to come with a... Yeah, more interesting way of looking at, also to help consumers, because if they have saved the money to buy a sofa, and then this person in the store says, and what kind of fabric would you like to have? And then everybody's like, oh my God, fabric, you know, what do I know about fabrics? Just do black or red and make it in wool. And for the rest, nobody knows. So that's why I wanted to come with a palette, collection of fabrics on one sofa. And I think it was also right in time, was the right timing. And when we approach it in Milano, the reaction were hate or love. It's very often when I show something, it's always you have people who hate it and you have people who loves it. And the love is now, there's more love than hate lately, so last year. So it's a classic in the collection, which means that it will have other lives than just this one time collection of fabric. So yeah, I'm very happy that that my first project for WeTra is immediately a classic and is in the, yeah, performed well, let's say that way.
So before we get to our last question, let's say the programmatic question, I would like to talk a little bit about texture. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about weaving fabrics and color, but what does mean texture to you? If you just like, let's say the word texture, what do you think about texture? How do you deal with it? How do you use it? What is it for you?
Well, I think texture makes a product human and physical. I think since we live in a digital world, we are in a flat world without any texture, which is good. It's efficient and it brings us a lot. But as soon as we are in a physical world, it's important that we design texture or tactility because I think this is a human part or a tool how you can communicate with humans. So tactility and texture is in weaving, in textiles, and you can design so many ways. And I think if we only rely on fast fashion industry, then all our textures are very flat and we are losing certain constructions, the way you weave, because all the prints are, you know, all the decorative prints are all printed. So nothing is woven. So all the constructions to make a print is all gone. The skills and these tools, also the looms. The looms are very, very, in the industry for fast fashion, are very, very efficient. So as a designer, you can't do anything because it has to be like in the split of a second, your shuttle needs to go up and down. And there's no way that that you use a yarn that ruins the efficiency of the loom. So the loom is no longer a creative tool. And so we are losing this whole cultural phenomenon weaving. That's why I study in it and try to find a way back, and also try to find what could be the future of an old craft like weaving. What could be a future for this? And yeah, I'm now the last years working on this 3D weaving. So we know 3D knitting, there's a lot of industries are working with this way of knitting. It's also easier in knitting, so we all know the sneakers. But for weaving, it's quite difficult because there are no looms. So we started to build looms to 3D weave. Then I think creating machines is also a way to create, to come up with questions on your answers and be creative with the machines. And I know that some of the bigger loom factories are also working with 3D weaving because it is the most strong and lightest construct that we have in the material world. So it has really a bright future in that sense. And then, you know, one of the topics that I also see as a future is programmable yarns. So solar yarns, conductive yarns. And as soon as if we have these yarns, we can program our 3D textiles. And you can have solar panel fields that are woven or are maybe more 3D sculptural, or it's a balcony that pops up, or it is a drone that can land very soft on a 3D landing system, or, you know, so there is a lot of future, I believe. And I'm not the only one. There are many people busy with 3D weaving. I don't see yet. We are all searching. So, and getting lost, but also I think I found now and with my team a very interesting way of doing this 3D weaving, but I need to go deeper in this programmable yarns to come with this high-tech solutions.
Wow. This is a very in-depth answer to, I think, my superficial question about textures. So, well, thank you very much for all these insights. So, you know, the subtitle of our podcast is What is Good? So my last question here is to you is, what is good?
What is good?
What is good?
Now it's getting silent because it's a very complex question, but it's also very simple.
It is, yeah.
I still keep it the relevance that it falls together with time. That is for me good. Then I good with different layers. Yeah, this will take hours before I have one quick answer. No, I'm already lost in my mind to come with a very sharp one-liner. Sorry.
This doesn't have to be a one-liner. And I think this is also an answer. It's a deep reflection. I think some people just answer too fast, shooting out of their hip, as you say. But I think it's a very good answer here. I've got one last question also concerning our, let's say, the design of our presentation of the series, because we've got colors as kind of coding for the profiles, for the portraits. I would like to ask you for two colors, which you would like, specific colors, let's say maybe a Pantone color, whatever, which you would like to have for your so-called tile that we have. It means it's the portrait. and the number of the DD cast. This is actually the first one I would really directly ask about these colors here on the program.
Okay.
Because I think you will come up with an idea which goes beyond just being colorful.
Mm-hmm.
If this is okay for you, I would just like...
Well, yeah, question. you know that I did wrote this book with Vitra about colors, and the title was, I don't have a favorite color. So your question is very, very brave. So that now I need to know before I can say what is my color. Is the tile from ceramic?
I will send you a sample, and this podcast, so you can make a choice how you would like to.
Yeah, I need to see what is the material. Has a glow, or what are the edges? So you know, a color fits to a certain product. I don't have this favorite color. I can't do it like this. I need to see the product. So
okay,
sorry.
Yeah. What other answer could you have given after this conversation? We're going to get along somehow, I'm sure. And our listeners will see what comes out of it.
Good.
So,
good.
Thank you very much again.
You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Das war Georg im Gespräch mit Hella Jongerius. Für die kommende Woche planen wir eine Sendung mit der Politikwissenschaftlerin und Hochschullehrerin Nicole Deitelhoff und dem Leiter des Frankfurter Museums für angewandte Kunst, Professor Matthias Wagner-Kahr, zum Thema Design und Demokratie. Was können DesignerInnen antidemokratischen Tendenzen entgegensetzen? Welche Rolle spielt Design für die demokratische Gesellschaft? Welchen Einfluss hat Design auf Partizipation, demokratische Prozesse und die notwendige Streitkultur? Und wie können DesignerInnen aktiv demokratische Politik stärken und mitgestalten? Diese Fragen stehen auch im Mittelpunkt der Bewerbung der Region Frankfurt-Rhein-Main um den Titel World Design Capital. Anlass genug, um hier die Diskussion, die wir bereits auf unserem Konvent Design for Democracy im März diesen Jahres ausführlich mit Workshops und Beiträgen aufgenommen haben, fortzusetzen. Ich bedanke mich sehr herzlich für eure Aufmerksamkeit und freue mich jetzt schon auf ein Wiederhören in der nächsten Woche. Bis dahin, alles Gute, eure DDcast-Redaktion.